The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Org. If we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
Welcome to Always Right Radio with Bob Frantz on AM 1420, The Answer.
Good morning, Cleveland, and everyone within the Salem 1420 WHK listening area, home of the smartest, strongest, fastest, toughest, and best-looking people in America. You're listening to Always Right on Salem 1420, The Answer. Pete Kersenow, substituting for the best radio talk show host in America, Bob Frantz. This Good Friday, March 29th, 2024. Boy, time flies. It really does. Most of you know I'm Bob's regular Tuesday at 10 guest, been doing that for a number of years now. My day job is as a lawyer, labor and employment lawyer, and I'm also a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. By the way, I should state right at the outset to anybody who's listening, and I may have said this yesterday, if I didn't, I was remiss. At the Civil Rights Commission, we adduce tons of evidence, lots of information that's very useful that contradicts almost everything that you hear in the prevailing media narrative. Almost everything, but because, as we all know, the media and progressives, but I repeat myself, I mean, they're virtually the same thing. The media actively ignore or suppress information that's contrary to the progressive narrative, to the Democratic narrative. So you won't hear about it unless you hear about it from a fellow civil rights commissioner of mine or me or someone else, or somehow it just gets leaked out. One of the gatekeepers missed what happened and forgot to close the gate so that that information doesn't get out. And as I said before, this information that we adduce, and it's on a whole host of subjects because unfortunately or fortunately, almost everything these days is considered a civil rights topic. And it's something that is quite eye-opening. I've been on the Civil Rights Commission now for nearly a quarter of a century. And almost everything I hear on the radio or television from the mainstream media is just a pale version of the truth at best, and usually just the opposite of what the truth is. So, but in any event, we're going to be talking about the cutting edge issues in America. Media and Democrats, but I repeat myself again, ignore it, distort it, outright lie about it. The stats and evidence show, in most cases, that conservatives are closer to the truth about a vast majority of issues prevailing in the country today. But media and the Democrats, but I repeat myself, bury it. So, trust your instincts. Do that. If there's some story you hear from major media and you think it's bunk, it probably is. So, today we have three guests. 9:30, we have John Stover of Ohio Value Voters. We'll be talking about the latest issues involving our schools. This is very important. I know all of you realize that. Our schools increasingly are They're indoctrinating as opposed to educating. Our students rapidly and alarmingly, astonishingly, fall behind at an amazing rate, that more so than any other nation, specifically China. The Civil Rights Commission noted that in Baltimore, for example, I'll just give you one example off the top of my head. The student with the highest grade point average in one of their schools, in a school of like 2,500 kids, the student with the highest grade point average had a D plus. A D plus. That's incredible. This is a monumental failure of our educational system. This cannot prevail. A country, a first world country, let alone the premier country in the world purportedly, can't have sustained failures like this and continue to prosper and continue to maintain our position as the number one country in the world. And we've been failing along these lines for at least 30 to 40 years, perhaps more. This is unforgivable. We'll be talking about that. At 10 o'clock, we have my colleague, J. Christian Adams. And he is the number one election law expert in the country. He was a former attorney in the voting rights section of the Department of Justice, and he was appointed by President Trump to the Civil Rights Commission. I've known him for a long time. He privately heads up the Election Law Center, and we're going to be asking him whether the GOP is prepared for this election cycle, whether or not they've caught up with Democratic shenanigans. You may recall 4 years ago, right around this time, I had Christian on the show when I was substituting, and I asked him how things look. Now, keep in mind, at this time, all of the polls were showing President Trump leading Joe Biden by at least 5 points. I thought this was going to be a cakewalk, and Christian turned to us and said, unequivocally, Trump was going to lose. No one else at that time was predicting that. Nobody. I asked, how could that possibly be? You know, I was highly skeptical. I had looked at the polls. I recited all of them in detail. And he said, look, there are a number of new things, new procedures that are being implemented and being employed by the Democrats and election officials, such as mail-in ballots, drop boxes, and those aren't necessarily new, but the scale of them was unprecedented. He said that the GOP hadn't caught up with that. And we then discovered, 8 months after that conversation, to our chagrin, Christian was exactly right. So here we are at around the same time in the election cycle, and I want to hear from him what he has to say. Have in the last 4 years, the Republicans gotten smart? Now, many of you may be skeptical, as am I, because we know our history, but it is imperative that they've caught up, because all the polls show Trump is going to win, every single one of them, whether it's head-to-head polls, matchups in individual states, whether it's right-track, wrong-track numbers, whether it's how people feel about their own personal situation. All these polls historically show a massive defeat. By massive, I mean, you know, 4 points, 5 points, 6 points, which is massive in a national election. A massive defeat for Joe Biden, and deservedly so. But as Joe Biden himself said, you know, it's not so much, it's almost a Stalinist formulation that he had about it's who counts the votes. Now, he was not smart enough to recognize how that sounded, but you know what? I think he was swerving toward the truth, at least the truth as the Democratic Party, at least the sentient ones, really perceived it. At 10:30, we've got Allison Soman from the Pacific Legal Foundation to talk about public schools and their insistence on continuing to discriminate on the basis of race. And I mean egregious discrimination, all in the name of quote-unquote equity, a phrase or a term you will not see in any statute. It's a made-up term because it doesn't mean equal treatment. It doesn't mean equal protection. It means equal results. Allison and the Pacific Legal Foundation were involved in the what was known as the TJ case, the Thomas Jefferson case that the Supreme Court denied cert on. Don't fall asleep on me. This is important, and it's interesting. The only Thomas and Alito dissented from that decision, and it is an important case with respect to affirmative action, racial preferences, etc. And if we have time, I'm going to ask her about the DEI loyalty oaths that teachers are increasingly required to pledge in schools throughout the country, a DEI or didn't earn it pledge that teachers are compelled to spout almost in the same fashion as the old communist bloc countries required. That's not an exaggeration. 11 o'clock is reserved solely for your calls. The 11 o'clock hour solely for your calls. The number 216-901-0945 or 888-281-1110. Again, 216-901-0945. Please call. Otherwise, I'll blow the eight or talk the ears off of my about my family members. My brother-in-law, who, by the way, is the model for the protagonist in my books, will have to listen to me. More accurately, I'll have to listen to him. You don't want that. I don't want that. It'll be a real problem. Oh, and we may have, at 11 o'clock, we may have Peter Jettick call, too. So, full slate, but we have some time in the last hour whenever there's a gap between guests. So please call and do me a favor, call or email. Please, everybody who's listening, I recognize it's Good Friday. You know, you've got other things to do. But if you have a chance, call or email the Cleveland Browns and tell them to put Kersenau in for one play this season. I'll sign a waiver and release. I will sign, you know, some type of rider to the collective bargaining agreement. I will waive any liability if I get killed. Absolutely. I'll join the NFLPA. It would be a ratings bonanza, a huge moneymaker for them because people turn in just to see if I get killed, okay? And I ask audience members who have, well, if you've seen me around at various speaking events or in person, whatever, to call in, okay? Let me know if you think I'll get killed. Would you pay for that spectacle? I'm assuming most of you would. I know my enemies would. Attorneys on the other side of most of my cases would. The ratings, I guarantee, Cleveland Browns, they will exceed the Super Bowl. So we've got a country to save. Let's get to it. Do we have time to take a call? Hey, let's try Jim in West Park. Jim, you there?
Yes, I am. I got 2 points real quick before the trucks show up with their long sleeve pajamas. One is the this book, Invisible Treason in America, and it's how they cheat. It's how they rig the elections with this invention after 9/11. This Dennis Montgomery developed this supercomputer, and this is what they do. The Chinese have been running our elections since 2005. They put Obama in with it, and it's all in there. It's called The Invisible Treason in America, okay? And here is one of Joe Bonehead's actual quotes. We're in a situation where we have put together, and you guys did it for President Obama's administration before this, we put together, I think, the most extensive an inclusive voter fraud organization in the history of American politics. My other point is about this boat crash, okay, and some of the fires. When they come out within minutes and say it was not a terrorist attack, they're lying to you. They come out and blame it on fuel. They blame it on this or that and the other thing. When within hours, it was a terror attack with plastic box cutters. Within hours, it was a guy that shot this out of sight rifle from the book depository window. They're lying to you. These fires, how can a wildfire, a brush fire, burn up and melt all this equipment in barns? Okay, and how can the boats out there in the harbor in Hawaii burn up by a fire on land?
Yeah, well,
that's all I got. That's it. I can't stay on the phone too long. They've already got my GPS coordinates.
All right, Jim. Well, thanks very much. I think Jim probably expresses concerns that a lot of people have, maybe a little bit more starkly. The concerns are when he's saying they're lying. I think a lot of us, you know, we may or may not agree with every point that Jim has made. We don't know. I mean, we can't know these things, of course, but it is interesting. I think that my takeaway from what Jim has to say is many of us do not trust our government. I remember growing up a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away where you implicitly trusted what the government had to say. And then over the course of half a century, we had so much evidence that the government was misrepresenting things, withholding things, outright lying. And I think there's a great deal of skepticism, which is unhealthy, by the way, for a democratic republic. We need to have an informed populace to make rational decisions or ask or make our representatives make rational decisions. But if our representatives are misrepresenting the truth, withholding truth, or outright lying, as we saw during Russiagate, remember, Russiagate from A to Z, from every dot on top of an I and cross the top of a T, was an utter and complete lie. For 4 years, every major network, every news outlet, the government, 51 intelligence professionals lied, and they knew they were lying. Maybe not all the news people, because they were getting their information from their pals on the left, the progressive politicians. But I don't think the news media, even if they suspected that maybe not everything they were getting from their pals was the truth, didn't care. They didn't investigate, and it was all there. It was just so ridiculous. Most of us didn't believe it, but they lied to us in an effort, first of all, to undermine the Trump candidacy and then to undermine the presidency. And what's astonishing, not only that, you know, you've got the relationship between Biden and various foreign entities and the money that's coming, but everyone keeps forgetting that it is we had the Obama administration spying on the Trump presidential campaign with the knowledge of every one of the principals. Remember the January 5th, 2021 meeting in the Oval Office just before the transition, where they were plotting how basically to continue spying on and undermining the Trump administration. Incredible thing. But the media downplays it. They ho-hum it to the extent they even report it. And it's not a big deal for some reason. This is one of the things, it's one of the challenges of the Republicans. Look, I have lots of problems with the Republicans. I think that very often they're too weak, not aggressive enough, not smart enough, not nimble and agile enough. But they understand that they have an uphill battle because the media is an arm of the Democratic Party. They will do everything they can to promote the Democratic Party. And they can't, meaning the Republicans, can't get a hearing. The stuff that's come out so far about Biden and Hunter Biden and the relationship with China and everything else is blockbuster. But it's only blockbuster in the minds of the beholder if the media treats it with the same degree of importance as they say would Watergate. Watergate was a pipsqueak compared to what's been revealed about the Obama and Biden administrations. Pipsqueak. But, you know, the old thing, if, you know, a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, here, if a scandal explodes but nobody reports it, is it a scandal? Folks, again, I hate to engage in this kind of conspiracy theorism or anything like that. It makes you sometimes sound like you may be a little bit off. But that's what's before us, and that's another advantage that they've got. They know that's precisely how people don't want to be perceived. But they don't have any problem engaging the wildest conspiracy theories and making it the focal point of their reporting. So that's where we are. One other thing I'd like to mention is most of you saw this, but it struck me, and I think it bears repeating last night. Last night, three presidents, Democrats, went to New York City and had a huge fundraiser for the cadaver in the White House, Joe Biden. Obama was there. Clinton was there. All the celebrities were there. All the right people were there. It was $250,000 to $500,000 a ticket, $100,000 to take a picture with these bozos, so-called celebrities, Stephen Colbert, Lizzo. I have no idea what she does. I don't watch enough TV or engage in these kind of things to understand these people. But this Lizzo person who looks like she's out of Star Wars or something. My question is, what are they buying for $500,000? $500,000 just to attend this? $100,000 to take a picture? What are they buying? Trump, on the other hand, look, I think Biden is supposed to have raised $25 million or $30 million, and all the talking heads in the media think it's such a big deal, it's such a big get, because, you know, he's going to need all that money for it, and he's going to outpace Trump by some huge margin in campaign financing. But that, the $24 million, whatever they raised, was eclipsed. In fact, that figure hurts them. It was eclipsed by the fact that Trump went to see, as he should have, as the president of the United States should have, especially in the context of his last debacle with respect to the legal alien that killed Laken Riley. Trump visits the slain officer's family and the cops. The cops were so appreciative. This guy who killed, the scum who killed the officer, had 21 arrests, but he was out on the street because Democratic Party prosecutors just cycle these guys through like it's nothing. But if you say the wrong thing, look the wrong way, spout the wrong opinion, they'll come after you and put you in jail like they did the January 6th protesters. I hear the bumper music that says Curse Now needs to stop bloviating and shut up. As I indicated, we're going to be talking to a lot of great people today, but we have time. As Bob, I think, says, if I've heard him correctly in the past, he says, hit them where they ain't. So when there are pauses in the interviews, please call in. You guys are great. I so much appreciate the opportunity Bob gives to talk to you guys because you're the best audience in all of America. This is Pete Kirsten now sitting for Bob France on Always Right. We'll be back.
Answer.
Hello again, Cleveland. Pete Kirstenow sitting in for the great Bob France here on this Good Friday. You know, we're in a post-Judeo-Christian society in many respects, kind of like the last stages or the late stages of the Roman Empire. And I think it's a good idea for us to talk to one of my favorite people, John Stover of Ohio Value Voters, whose organization does great work. Now, you know, we like to talk about the technological competition with China, for example, and making sure that we are doing the best we can for our children with respect to education, all that stuff. But values are what made the United States different, set us apart from all the other countries. We had a certain set of values. They were Judeo-Christian values. And I think to the extent we depart from them, we depart from America and we sow the seeds for our own demise. That's just me. Okay, I can't cite you. You know how I like to cite statistics. There's all kinds of statistics that show that we're going in the wrong direction. And I think most Americans concur we're on the wrong track if you look at the polling, aside from a political standpoint. But I do think that there are certain foundational aspects to society that once they become weak, no matter how technologically advanced you are, no matter how wealthy you are, you're going to start to deteriorate. Victor Davis Hanson knows this very well. He's talked about it, as does John Stover. John, how are you? Are you there?
Yes, I am, Peter. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us. Ohio Value Voters, one of my favorite organizations. You guys do yeoman's work. Let's get right to it. John, I've talked to you a number of times, and every time I talk to you, you've got some insight as to what is going wrong and what can be done to turn the ship around in this country. And as our friend Larry Elder says, and I know I repeat this every single time I get on, but I think it's so succinctly stated, we've got a country to save. And I think, you know, to the extent 4 or 5 years ago, people didn't think that we were on the precipice. More and more often, we hear from ordinary people and also very important people, or at least very high visibility people, that the country, in many respects, measurably is deteriorating and going in the wrong direction. And I think one of the reasons is with respect to values, but it starts with the kids in our school system. John, just a kind of 50,000 or 30,000 foot view, maybe a little bit closer to earth, your assessment as to the most pressing issues facing parents with kids, especially in the public school system, but just generally.
Yes. Well, let me, first of all, Peter, once again, thank you for having me on today. I would want to say this, you know, this time of year that we celebrate outside of our Lord and Savior's birth and Christmas time, that this is one of the most important days that we remember, and that is the glorious resurrection of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And I just wish everyone out there a happy Easter, listeners today. But, you know, one of the things that, and I couldn't agree with you more, Peter, when you mentioned the issues that we have in education. And, you know, I have to say that it's just a matter of time. I firmly believe this. I don't have a crystal ball, nor do I have a you know, I'm a prophet, but I will say this, it's just a matter of time before you have your own radio station, and please consider Peter Kersenow, never woke. You know, you have Bob France always right, Peter Kersenow never woke. But
well, you get the royalties on that.
You know, but a couple of websites that I direct your listeners to, OhioValuableOrders.org, and people can sign up to receive our updates. Relative to what's going on in the state of Ohio primarily. We do touch matters that relate to Congress. And then protectohiochildren.net. We're doing something out there that no other state in the country is doing that I'm aware of. And I get my wife, Diane, who has the computer skills to put this out there. We have a grid map. We have all 600-plus school districts, and we have the opportunity for whether they're teachers, students, parents, just whistleblowers. They will contact us and say, this is what's going on as it relates to DEI, or, you know, sexual education is being taught that should not be taught, or, you know, trying to put boys that all of a sudden their gender, their identity is that of a girl. They want to go into a girl's bathroom, but they need to go to protectohiochildren.net and take a look at that. And they can also pull up their school district. You know, one of the things, Peter, that I always stress anytime I speak to parents or we travel the state to speak to groups of people is, you know, some of the rights that parents have. And this right has been out there for a long time in our the laws that we have in the state of Ohio. And for your listeners, I urge them to get a pen or pencil if you have parents with children in the public school system, Ohio Revised Code 3313.60, Section G, which basically states that a parent or legal guardian has the right to go into that school district and demand to see, and it has to be immediate. This is even better than a public records request by, you know, by law in the state of Ohio. But immediately, the school district must present every piece of material that their child is being subject to, every piece of it. They have a chance to review that. And
John, let me stop you right there, because I want to emphasize that. I think that's invaluable information for our listening public. Ohio Revised Code, everyone knows when I'm giving speeches out there, I say, you know, put a pen and paper, a pencil and paper next to your phone so you can record certain things, remind yourself of calling certain representatives. But Ohio Revised Code 3313.60G, okay? I think John's exactly right. This gives you the ability to pierce the veil so that, you know, very often parents don't know what's going on. And on occasion, it is true the schools actively try to obfuscate what they're doing. You've heard the reports. And John, I don't mean to take your thunder here. I know you're going to talk about these things, but they actively try to obfuscate or shield what they're doing with kids from parents. Like not telling parents that their kids are transitioning or want to transition or insisting upon being called a name other than their given name. John, go ahead. Sorry for interrupting.
No, you're absolutely right, Peter. And this is why this specific Ohio Revised Code is so important for parents or legal guardians. Just real quick, we had a situation about 3 years ago where a parent in the Rocky River School District says, you know, he said, I'm not able to get the material that I'm requesting. I said, you know what, print this out. Print the specific law out, take it to the school board president, and hand it to him or her and say, look, you're in violation of the law. If you do not contact me within a reasonable period of time, I will have to contact my legal counsel because you are in violation of the law in the state of Ohio. Sure enough, within 2 days. She was called back in and had an opportunity to review all material.
Mm-hmm.
I would also want to state this. I don't know if you saw recently, Peter, but the report basically states that in the state of Ohio, we have passed fewer bills at this point in time in the General Assembly than at any other time over the past 40 years. They've only passed 19 bills, and normally the average has been over the last 40 years, 230 bills each session is normally passed. Now, one may ask, well, why is that? Well, a lot of it has to do with the gang or the Blue 22 and electing Speaker Stevens. And we have a number of good bills that if we have time, I certainly want to cover. But, you know, one of the things that you had mentioned, Peter, was the fact that, you know, parents hiding, school administrators, be it the superintendent, teachers, school board, hiding specific information from parents. You know, we had within the last year a couple of lawsuits that had taken place, one in the Hilliard City School District, which parents got together and said that the school district was having intimate sexual conversations with students that parents had no knowledge of. That's one situation that we had in the state of Ohio over the past year. And then we had in Bethel, Ohio, we had a group of Muslim and Christian parents. And
yeah, I'm familiar with that one. Yeah.
Yeah, the AFL, American First Legal, they sued the school board because of the fact that they were attempting to have biological boys that all of a sudden they determined that they were their gender identity was that of a girl. They were going to allow these boys to access the girls' bathrooms. And that was another issue that parents had brought and decided to file a lawsuit. You know, it's unfortunate today, but, you know, this is what we see. We see this not only in the state of Ohio, but across the country. And one of the most progressive states to do the right thing on behalf of parents is certainly the state of Florida. And, you know, my wife and I, we had an opportunity to sit in a meeting in Lee County, which is the county for Cape Coral, Fort Myers, and we had two state representatives there. And I basically stood up and stated to these two gentlemen after they had had finished speaking, I said, look, we appreciate everything that you're doing in Florida because once you pass these laws, this is something that our organization, Ohio Value Voters, looks to obtain all the information and then find a legislator. And we do have some good legislators, both in the Senate side and in the House side, that want to do the right thing on behalf of parents. So we'll take those bills and forward them to them and say, look, this is something that we need to get behind.
Right. And, you know, Florida has shown the way. They're like the Army Rangers of state legislatures. Florida shows the way. But what's interesting to me is, again, I've been around for a long time, and the trajectory of what's going on in schools is alarming. Not just alarming, but it's puzzling and stunning to me. There seems to be a proliferation of school administrators and teachers who are so obsessed with sex. We are failing with respect to reading, writing, and arithmetic. Our kids are falling way behind other nations. But at the same time, we're so immersed in sex education. I'm not saying, you know, that, you know, the biological implications of sex and all that stuff shouldn't necessarily be taught, but there's an obsession with this, and in many cases, a bizarre and almost perverted obsession. Why were all these administrators that are insistent on things such as assisting kids with transitioning or shielding from parents the fact that they are using different pronouns or even names in school, shielding it from parents? But John, what's behind all of this?
Yeah, that's that's just once again the day and age that we're living in. It's, I tell you, Peter, lack of a better way to describe it, is just the evilness that we're dealing with. Whether we're talking about the Ohio Education Association, National Education Association, many of these teacher unions, it's a case where, you know, they feel that they have the ultimate right. They have the ultimate right to determine what will be taught to the children of parents in the state of Ohio, which parents have the ultimate right to determine what is to be taught to their children, and they have an ultimate right to know of this material. You know, a good bill, we have a very, very good bill that's sitting out there that D.J. Swearingen is the state representative. He introduced House Bill 8. And it's titled Parents' Bill of Rights. And it has to do with the parents' right to make decisions concerning their children. And the bill basically states that they have a fundamental right to decisions concerning the upbringing, education, and care of their children and child in the school. You know, this is one of the reasons why the Ed Choice program was passed here recently. And that Ed Choice programs provide parents with the right to, you know, send their child with using monies that normally would go to the public school district, public school system, but to send their child to a private school. Also a good bill, House Bill 339, that Representative Click has introduced. That's going to address some of the schools, Christian schools, that were not included as part of the Ed Choice program. And, you know, you would think that, you know, the world is ending as far as some of these school administrators are concerned. You know, how could you be taking money from the public schools? And, well, wait a minute. This is not your money to begin with. This is the taxpayers' monies that we're talking about here. These are the parents' dollars that we're talking about. They have the right to determine what their child will be taught, and they have the right to basically say, look, we're not going to allow you to indoctrinate our child with, you know, the DEI or critical race or this gender trans, you know, dysphoria and so forth. So, you know, these are some of the bills. I had another bill, a great bill, Senate Bill 83, which Jerry Serino, State Senator Jerry Serino introduced. It was early last year. It's been sitting out there for a year. It's been held up in the House by Jason Stevens, passed the Senate, sitting in the House right now. But this bill has everything to do with higher education and deal with the wokeness and all of the nonsense that's going on there. But that bill is being held up as well. So you know, Peter, it's just a situation and case where in the state of Ohio, you know, the electorate permitted the Republican Party to hold a supermajority in the House and Senate. And because of what transpired relative to the, once again, the Blue 22, Ganga 22, and the fact that they went against their word to support the individual that had been elected the next speaker in Derek Marin, they went with the Jason Stevens and working with the Democrats reaching across the aisle. They ended up putting him as the speaker, and all these deals that were cut with the Democrats is one of the reasons some of these bills are being held up.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little dispiriting when you see politicians kind of joining with the forces of darkness, as it were, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but we do have a trajectory, not just in terms of educational achievement, but in terms of character development. And again, what I'm seeing is, and my kids are growing, but I have grandkids, and what I'm seeing, and I'm very worried about, is how, number one, our kids are not being educated. By every metric, things are going in the wrong direction. And the thing I point to very often for people, the simplest, you can look at test scores, National Association of Educational Progress scores ad infinitum that show things are getting worse and worse, or if anything, are just simply staying level despite the infusion of billions of dollars into these schools. We have a Department of Education that was established in the late 1970s, and education scores have gone down. We used to be number one in the world in various metrics such as math, and now, as I say all the time, all the listeners who've heard me say, we're 39th in math, 39th, and we're so immersed in these sociological issues in schools that used to be the province of parents. And I'd like to ask you, John, because every time I've dealt with you, you've been extremely wise. My view, and I think that of some listeners I've talked to in the past, is that, among other things, we have a society, one of the reasons we have this kind of dysfunction in schools in addition to the broader society is the proliferation of single parents, where we have nearly 40% of all kids are born into single-parent households. In minority communities and black community, it's upwards of 75%. And it's hard enough. I know I've got kids, as I've said, it's hard enough when you've got two parents to be able to monitor what's going on with your kids' education and their social activities. But one parent, When that happens, I think the vacuum is filled by administrators, teachers, the contractors that come into schools. Do you see, do you have, because you're really involved in this stuff, do you sense that that may be one of the issues, one of the problems leading to this bizarre growth in extracurricular issues that the schools are immersed in?
No, there's no doubt about that, Peter. We've seen over the years, as you stated, one parent in the household trying to raise children. You know, the plan that God had established was for two parents, and you know, the government has been a catalyst in some respects. And we go back to the '60s, and we don't have time to discuss some of the programs that were put in place that basically enhanced the opportunities for, of course, one parent. And, you know, we can also trace this to many of the situations that we see today regarding crime in our nation.
Yeah.
The fact that it's one parent. You know, I would be willing to say that if we went to the prison systems today and we saw that, you know, we were to have the opportunity to interview some of these men that have been incarcerated, we would find that, and this is, you know, not a race issue. This has to do with black and white and, you know, Hispanic, et cetera. But if you were to ask them, you know, what was your home life like? Many of them would say, you know, that they were raised by one parent and they got involved with, you know, the wrong crowd, et cetera. And that's why they're there now. You know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, government has set itself up to be God in our nation. You know, we will provide you with everything that you need. Whatever it may be, we will provide it to you. And, you know, it's and as I say, Peter, we can get into a number of other avenues to discuss as it relates to the open borders and just how our tax dollars are being spent as far as the illegal immigrants that are coming across and, you know, taking them into different cities and putting them up. And, you know, this is all a cost to the taxpayers. I saw a report recently that basically stated that in Ohio alone, it's been like $82 million that the state has spent addressing illegal immigration. You look at California, Texas, and then New York, they're into the billions of dollars. But, no, to get back to your original comment, Peter, you're absolutely right. Single parent is one of the major issues. That's
yeah, and John, I know you well enough that I think I can speak for you. Neither of us are condemning single parents who are trying their best to navigate the shoals of society with their kids and raising them the right way. But
that's
the
right.
Metrics are clear that dual parent families do much better. Their kids do much better. They've got better prospects, better outcomes in terms of income and educational levels for a whole host of reasons. And society should be promoting the ideal of a two-parent family, assisting single-parent families where necessary without promoting that. But I think it's imperative that we understand that the dual-parent family for a long time has been the basic building block of any successful civilization. And our government, unfortunately, is doing everything in its power, overtly and expressly, to undermine that. It's a truly extraordinary thing. We shouldn't permit that. It's the building block of society. But more important, it keeps at bay the intrusive government. I hear the music to tell me that we're going to break soon. John, it's always a great pleasure to talk to you. It's Ohio Value Voters. John, can you give them the website again? Because among all the websites, I usually scroll through a number of websites every morning. And, you know, I mentioned yesterday Center for Immigration Studies. Ohio Value Voters is one of them. Can you give them the website again?
Yes, OhioValueVoters.org and ProtectOhioChildren.net. And, Peter, once again, thank you for having me on. God bless you and all the work that you do. And once again, happy Easter to you and the listeners.
Thanks, John. Happy Easter to you. So that was John Stover, Ohio Value Voters. We'll be going to break. Are we going to spend the entire time on break? Is that it? I guess so. So we're going to go to a break. We're going to come back. When we come back, I think I've got J. Christian Adams coming up. You're not going to want to miss this, okay? Because he is the authority on election law and what to expect in the election. If you think there are going to be shenanigans, He's the guy to go to, and he'll be on shortly. This is Pete Kersenow substituting for Bob France. Always right.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
This is Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer. With your host, Bob France.
Good morning, Cleveland. It's not Bob France, it's Pete Kersenow. You know me. For the last 8-9 years, I've been the Tuesday guest of Bob's, causing him great consternation, no doubt. And he, every once in a while, jeopardizes the FCC license of this station by allowing me to, or asking me, to guest host. So far, I don't see anybody pulling up outside the door. As you know, I sometimes get under the nerves of our local FBI officials, and we always have someone on the outside over here, outside the studio, looking for the FBI van, and it's not there. So I'm going to continue to move forward and ruffle feathers and call people out. And no one better to do that with than my colleague on the Civil Rights Commission, J. Christian Adams. Christian is, he knows everything pertaining to elections and voting. There's nobody better. He is head of the Public Interest Legal Foundation, Election Law Center. He was a member of the voting section of the Department of Justice, the voting rights section of the Department of Justice, where I got to know him when he testified before the Civil Rights Commission. His testimony turned out to be a nationwide story at the time, implicating the Biden administration, or not the Biden, but the Obama administration. And we have a lot of fun on the Civil Rights Commission because we address all kinds of bizarre issues. Christian, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Pete. Thanks for having me.
Great. Hope you have a happy Easter. Let me get that out first. And we've got a solemn Good Friday. It is a holiday that I take very, very seriously, but I'm not going to dwell upon that. Let's talk about, you know, I was just telling the audience in the last hour that you may not remember this, but it was almost 4 years ago to the day I spoke with you on the phone. The polls at that time showed that Trump had a sizable lead over Biden, anywhere from 5 to 6 points. The talking heads all were in agreement that this was going to be, if not a cakewalk, it was Trump's election to lose. There are no dark clouds on the horizon for his reelection. I was feeling pretty good about it. And I remember it was right around, you know, the pandemic was April. And I remember sitting in my office and I had a conversation with you where I said, you know, I was feeling pretty jubilant about the prospects. And you said, we're going to lose. And I was stunned by that. I was just completely flabbergasted. And you went through a litany of different procedural issues that Republicans had been asleep at the switch as to the different election law changes that were going on, ostensibly in response to COVID, but you were prescient enough to understand that the Democrats were utilizing this going forward to cement in place procedures that gave them a significant advantage. And we are here again. Here we are 4 years later, and I'm looking at the polls. And right now, the polls look almost the same as they did very eerily 4 years ago. Trump is ahead in every battleground state. And some of them are amazing, such as Michigan, 3.5. I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics average of polls. Even Wisconsin, it's, you know, margin of error, obviously, but 0.08. In Pennsylvania, again, very narrowly close. But North Carolina, Nevada, Michigan, Georgia, he's got Arizona, he's got sizable leads in these places. And the trajectory appears as if, you know, there's no way in the world, all things being equal, that Trump is going to lose. Christian, from your perspective, because you do this on a daily basis, have the Republicans learned the lesson of 2020?
Well, to a large extent, they have, Pete. They've learned the lesson. Whether they implement safeguards to act upon that knowledge is the big question now. In some states, they are. In some states, they aren't. There's good news. There's bad news. It depends on which state we're talking about. Going back to what you said about April or this time in 2020, let's not forget, the reason that he was soaring to reelection is because of the incredibly good job that President Trump's administration and President Trump did. I mean, the economy was roaring. We hadn't learned terms like supply chain shortages. We hadn't seen the pandemic wreak havoc on what was pretty much as good as it gets. I mean, you know, I love Ronald Reagan. I lived through that. But Donald Trump was really as good as it gets. I mean, we hadn't seen something like that in this country for a very long time as far as, I mean, black unemployment, for example, record lows, employment, record highs. I mean, any metric there was, we were soaring in America and roaring back to reelection.
Right. And it's every metric. It was not just blacks, it was Hispanics, females, just in record highs in, with respect to everything. How much money you had in your pocket after taxes and disposable income, purchasing power. And as Trump says accurately, but the media won't report it because they're actively suppressing any good news from Trump and any bad news, which is constantly, that's their whole job, suppressing news every single day because it's coming from Biden. But, you know, we didn't have wars sprouting throughout the world. We didn't have these overt threats. China was kept in check. So was Russia. And inflation, immigration, probably the biggest issue on the minds of most people. It has tremendous ramifications. Everything was in decent shape, if not best. I agree with you. I grew up, I mean, I didn't grow up, but I lived through the Reagan era. And as much as I admired Reagan, Trump, in my estimation, is doing did a better job. We had better circumstances under Trump. Different environment, obviously. He doesn't have to deal with the evil empire of the Soviet Union. But by every metric, Trump is his record was better than that of Reagan's. And I know that sounds sacrilegious here on Good Friday, but nonetheless, it was. And I can't remember in my lifetime a disaster, a man-made disaster. You can point to certain policy prescriptions by the Biden administration and draw a straight line to some calamity that it created. This guy, in my estimation, I agree with Trump. He is, meaning Biden, the worst president at bare minimum of my lifetime, and I'm a little bit of an amateur historian. I say a good case can be made that maybe with the exception of James Buchanan and a few others, the worst president in history. But, Christian, where do you feel some confidence that maybe the Republicans, I know the Democrats are always maneuvering with respect to some new technique or practice with respect to voting, but do you think the Republicans are more vigilant this year than they were 4 years ago?
Yes. I mean, for starters, I don't think there's any chance that places like the city of Philadelphia will be able to repeat the nonsense they did where, and look, you have to get down in the weeds on what happened in Philly with the law, but essentially they created these voting centers that were so androgynous statutorily. In other words, they didn't quite fit a precinct and they didn't quite fit an election office, that none of the laws of observation were applied there. In other words, they had these, like, imagine like the Philly Spectrum or, I mean, people, that's an old reference, but I forget what they call it now, Wells Fargo. Like, imagine a big voting center that gets set up and then the observers are told, oh, you're not allowed in to watch. And that's essentially what happened in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And that's one of many, many examples of the law just becoming a sideshow. It wasn't binding. You know, the statutes were no longer observed because we had an emergency. And so what it became was a free-for-all, particularly in places like Philadelphia. I want to tell you one more thing about Pennsylvania and why it's so dangerous. Pennsylvania has local home rule, and you are not allowed to observe an election in Pennsylvania unless you are from that county. So the problem the Republicans have because of this law, Pete, is they can't find anybody to be observers on election day.
Yeah.
Because in Philadelphia, everybody's afraid, and that can cycle us back to 2010 with the new Black Panthers. But the point is that people are afraid in Philly to be observers. And so it's a lopsided, you know, process where one side has advantages, the other doesn't.
What's the ostensible basis for that rule that observers have got to be from that? Do they even try to give an explanation for that?
Well, I mean, yeah, kind of, because we've been looking at ways to challenge it in the courts, you know, because courts are the law is not very happy about, well, you can't speak if you're not from the state, right? You're not allowed to publish a book unless you're a resident. You know, it's like we have a tradition on this one. But the point is that they say, oh, well, you know, we want people close by. You know, it's like, but the reality is it was the Democrat legislature, you know, in ages past that enacted the statute that basically makes Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, probably Center County, which is State College, an absolute free-for-all of one-party rule. And that's exactly what it is to this day.
Yeah. And, Christian, I want to emphasize something with the audience, because when I'm out here speaking locally, this question comes up all the time. People are very, very concerned about voter fraud. And I've been in hearings at the Civil Rights Commission where our progressive allies try to say there's no such thing as voter fraud. There's no evidence of voter fraud, nothing like that. This is a made-up situation. You were right there on the ground all of the time. And I know in Ohio, I think it was in the 2016 election, there were 81 separate elections that were decided by just one vote. So it's crucial to make sure that the count is accurate. And when we're talking about fraud, one vote can make a difference. Two votes can make a difference. You see this all the time. How do you respond to Democrats who say, or the media, but I repeat myself, it's not an issue?
Yeah, a couple ways. First of all, Pete, the Public Interest Legal Foundation, that's publicinterestlegal.org, has a database called the Tied Election Database. We store all of the elections around the country that ended in a tie, and it's upwards of 700 in the last couple of years. So this is not a rare thing that elections end in a tie. Control of the Virginia House was decided by a coin flip a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the Heritage Foundation has a great voter fraud database. You can go look there. So you combine the two, the Heritage Voter Fraud Database with our tie election database, you see it's a real problem. But I think folks need to understand it's way more complicated than just voter fraud. It's the system
right.
has been created with vulnerabilities. It's like building a ship and you have some panels at waterline made out of balsa plywood instead of steel. And so you have situations like Nevada, Pete, where they have automatic vote by mail. Every single registered name on the voter rolls gets mailed a ballot, no longer whether they're dead, alive, moved to Utah. And so you create this balsa wood battleship or balsa wood ship that is just filled with problems. And it's even worse than just voter fraud. It's vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and that's a great description of it. Another issue that I'm concerned with that comes up from time to time is double voting. In other words, people who've got multiple residences, and they may vote in Florida. You know, they may be sunbirds or whatever, and they vote in Florida. And then, you know, they happen to move up to Ohio or move up to Pennsylvania and vote there. I am told by my progressive friends, the one or two that I have, that this is not an issue. How do you perceive that?
Well, I know it's an issue because one of the things the Public Interest Legal Foundation has done, at great expense, I might add, this is not easy to do, is we have done state-by-state comparisons. We have compared the voter rolls in Ohio and the voting history in Ohio to the voting history in Florida and other states, and we have generated huge lists of names that have locked down date of birth, full name, social security number, which we have access to, and we have found instance after instance of double voting. And curiously, it often involves husband and wife. In other words, both the husband and wife are casting double votes. And that tells you it's a real behavior. This is not a data glitch. And we have taken this data directly to state election officials in various states. They have prosecuted people, and people have pled guilty based on this. So it is a real thing. We just won a case in the First Circuit Court of Appeals. You're not going to believe this. And First Circuit is a federal circuit in Boston that has the New England states. We beat Maine on summary judgment. They were trying to hide their voter roll from us, saying that if we couldn't get it, and if we did get it, we couldn't talk about what we find. I swear to God, that was what the law said. We were not allowed to speak about problems we found on the voter roll. That is a state law that was passed in direct response to my work. And we defeated that law in the trial court. Maine appealed it to the First Circuit Court of Appeals, who struck down the state law that limited our ability to speak about people voting in multiple states. That's literally what the law prevented us from talking about, was any Mainers who were committing voter fraud. So it's a full frontal attack.
Amazing.
It's the government, it's left-wing groups. All of them are trying to hide the truth about this.
You know, in every election, at least presidential election cycle, you've got only a handful of states that truly are in play. And they're called the battleground states, for lack of a better term. And in the past couple of elections, they've pretty much remained the same. It's like Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona. I mean, there are states with big electoral catches, such as Ohio, but they're not really in play. It's a +8 red state. Is there a particular jurisdiction that you see as more problematic than others, or a handful of jurisdictions? If so, which ones are they?
Yeah. So at the top of the list, as I said earlier, Nevada is a gigantic problem because they have dirty voter rolls and automatic mail out. In other words, folks, you got to understand this. You might not have understand this the first time I said it. Every single person on the voter rolls in Nevada automatically, without request, has a ballot mailed to them. So you've got millions of ballots right. being dropped in the mail. That is the worst way to run an election. At least you ought to request it, right? At least you ought to have to ask to have it mailed. But in Nevada, everybody gets mailed, and then the voter rolls are a wreck. So they're going to – I've been there. I was there recently documenting this. They're going to casinos. They're going to Larry Flynt's Hustler Club. I'm not kidding. They're going to head shops and bars and vacant lots. Sorry?
Did you go there by any way, Christian?
Sorry?
I'm sorry. Bad joke. I was just asking whether you went to Larry Flynt's Hustler Club. Because this is important stuff. You need to research this.
I was there with the camera crews taking pictures. So I'll send you some of the photos of it. So anyhow, on the outside, by the way. So we were documenting the problem. Okay, so Nevada's bad. Michigan's bad because you got a radicalized Secretary of State there.
Yeah.
Her name is Jocelyn Benson. She is a progressive ideologue who worked at the Southern Poverty Law Center. They've got tens of thousands of dead people on their voter rolls in Michigan. I know this because we've been litigating against them on this issue. So that's those are my two most dangerous places. Pennsylvania is slightly improving from some decent court rulings, one of which just happened in the Third Circuit 2 days ago. Wisconsin has got an army on the ground, which is good, an army of activists who are watching and fighting to make sure things run well, which is different than 4 years ago, I might add. And so there's good and there's bad. North Carolina's improved. Florida and Ohio are great. You know, they're great now. Florida's the best in the country for running elections. We have a report called Worst to First. That's Florida. It went from the worst state to the first state. And so there's good and there's bad.
I see. And one of the issues that this audience has called me about on a regular basis, and I don't know to what extent this is an issue, but a lot of people are very concerned when they look at the southern border and see armies coming across of millions and millions of people, and many of them are wearing Biden-Harris t-shirts. And when they're interviewed, they say, oh, yeah, we're for Biden and Harris. Is there any issue with respect to the potential of illegal aliens voting, and if they did vote in certain narrow jurisdictions or narrowly contested jurisdictions, could that be a problem?
Well, this is a really complicated question that we could talk about for a very long time on a whole show, but I'll try to give you some highlights because we've been researching this for years and litigating it. We won a case in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in order to get alien voting records, so we have a well-trod history here. And here's some, I'll give you good news, bad news. The good news is that there's more systems in place now to stop it than there were 8 years ago. States who have moved to Real ID have tools to prevent it. The good news is illegal aliens tend not to be the ones who register to vote. I've seen data on this. I've collected data on this. It tends to happen through motor voter, people who have green cards who get caught in the motor voter DMV voter registration net. It tends to happen to student visa holders. And so the data that we have, that we've collected, shows 95% of it is not illegal aliens because they're afraid, right? They generally mm-hmm. want to hide under rocks and not show themselves. So they don't stroll into the election office usually to register. Now, some do. Some do. The bad news is that there is no citizenship verification of any sort when people register to vote, generally speaking, because the federal government is not allowing states to effectively use federal government databases. You might remember, Pete, we just had a hearing with DHS at the Civil Rights Commission, and I asked a series of questions. When they take biometric information, I asked, like, do they do it at apprehension? Well, that was all because I was trying to gauge what's feeding into this federal database about aliens. And the federal government is not sharing it as much as they should be.
Yeah. And my concern, I recognize that, and I understand that answer. My concern has been not so much that, and I, by the way, I talked to Mark Krikorian yesterday on the show, and he's in alignment with you. My concern has been that the influx of illegal aliens will have a different electoral impact in terms of the number of electoral votes that would be awarded to certain states or representatives. And I do think this is all purposeful. But I hear the bumper music. Christian, it was great talking to you again. Look forward to seeing you at the next commission meeting. You have a good Friday and a great Holy Week. It's already over, but a good Easter. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks very much.
Take care, Pete.
That was J. Christian Adams, my colleague. We're going to be going to the bottom of the hour, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Allison Soman about race discrimination in the schools. This is Pete Kersenow. I'm filling in for the great Bob France on Always Right.
And the answer.
Welcome back, folks. Obviously, this is not Bob France. We're continuing our string of excellent guests. This is Pete Kersenow substituting for Bob France on Always Right. And we just got finished talking about the whole issue with respect to the election. We had some wonderful insights as to whether or not we should have any concerns about the integrity of the election. And these are, you know, we're not going to engage in histrionics here. We had a very insightful discussion about certain potential problems, but also that it appears as if, but we always have to remain vigilant, it appears as if many of the problems, at least Republicans and conservatives, are aware of and should be vigilant about. One of the things that we should be vigilant about, as I said at, I think, the first hour, is our educational system, what's going on there in terms of the ABCs, but also the construct of the educational system, the manner in which it operates, and is it doing so with the idea of American values in mind, especially with respect to equal protection, et cetera. Over the last, 30, 40 years, we've seen all manner of machinations on the part of, you know, maybe not even political people, but to shape the educational system in their own vision. And one of those has been overt discrimination against certain groups of people. And we just recently had the Students for Fair Admissions case, seminal Supreme Court case related to whether or not racial preferences, SFFA versus Harvard, racial preferences were permissible and to what extent they would be permissible, because we have seen throughout academia over the last 40 years, and it's been changing somewhat in terms of the demographics, but there is extreme overt discrimination against Asian Americans, somewhat lesser extent whites, and extreme discrimination in favor of blacks and to a lesser extent Hispanics. I'm happy to have with us Allison Soman from the Pacific Legal Foundation, which has been doing yeoman's work in battling discrimination on a whole host of levels. And they were involved in one of the more famous cases, which we'll be talking about. It's an important case because it was a Fourth Circuit case, and the Supreme Court, and I'll let Allison talk about this because she understands it and she's much smarter than I am on these issues, but the name of the case is Coalition for TJ. That's Thomas Jefferson, one of the premier, if not the premier, high school in the entire country, versus Fairfax County School Board. Allison, are you there?
I am here. It's great to be here today, Peter.
Oh, thanks for having us. Allison's one of the smartest people you're ever going to want to meet, along with her husband, Ilya. Many of you are familiar with his work. But Allison is a member of the Pacific Legal Foundation, which was involved in the litigation. The Supreme Court recently denied cert, disappointing a lot of us. Allison, can you tell us a little bit? This audience is not aware, at least most of the audiences may not be aware of the case and what it was all about. Can you give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what it was about?
Sure. So Thomas Jefferson High School in Alexandria, Virginia, is a magnet school that specializes in education for gifted students in the areas of science, mathematics, technology, and engineering. It's been rated the number one public high school in the United States by U.S. News & World Report. It graduates lots of kids who go on to fantastic colleges and do wonderful things in science, engineering, and in other fields. After we won in district court, a guy posted on Twitter that he founded several companies and that employ hundreds of people, all because of the special push that he got from the challenging education at TJ. That story is his personal story, but there are dozens of others that are similar about how being in this special, high-powered environment spurred its graduates to take on new challenges, whether at school or in the working world in science and related fields. So this system seemed to be working out pretty well for most everybody, except in the fall of 2020, the Fairfax County School Board got rid of the admissions exam that had been used to play a large part in picking out who would go to TJ and replaced it with a complicated system where for most students, the particular middle school where they went to would determine whether or not they got to go to TJ. Under the new plan, the top 1.5% of every middle school automatically got admitted to TJ. And for the remaining slots coming from an under middle school, got you a significant number of points. Why did they do this? Well, overwhelmingly, it looks like it was because of race. The board felt that there were too many Asian American students at TJ and not enough students from other racial groups. And so they restructured the admissions process to get the student body they wanted. In the past, TJ had been about 76% Asian in the admitted class. In the year after they reinstituted the new changes, that number dropped to 54%.
That's a significant drop. And what about Black and Hispanic admittees? Did that go up?
Yes, those numbers went up. And the board was very clear throughout all their deliberations that they wanted a student body that would be more Black, more Hispanic, and less Asian American. And that was why they got rid of the test and put into place this complicated system with middle school attendance driving the bus. Basically, Asian American kids in Fairfax County tend to attend particular middle schools. And so if you have this system of middle school quotas, you can get the racial results you want without having to say that you're using race, even though pretty much everybody involved understood what was really going on.
Allison, it's pretty unusual, don't you think, for a school to just blatantly admit that they're discriminating on the basis of race to get a certain racial composition in their school? I mean, they have expressed what their motive and intent is, which is something we typically don't see in litigation. I mean, Harvard bent over backwards trying to say, oh, no, we're just trying to get the best students, blah, 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 blah. Did the court make any mention of that, the fact that it looks like this was specific intent on the part of the school board to get a certain racial mix?
So the board denied that that was what they were doing, but we have voluminous messages, text messages, emails produced in discovery that make it pretty clear to any reasonable finder of fact that their goal was, in fact, racial. I wish it were true that it was uncommon for school boards to say that their goals are racial. Unfortunately, we have three other PLF cases that are earlier in the pipeline than TJ, but that involve pretty good record evidence of a school board restructuring admissions processes at a magnet school to try to get a racial outcome. The one behind TJ that's farthest along is about Boston Latin School, a famous magnet school in Boston that has educated a lot of famous New Englanders. That case, there'll be a cert petition filed in the Supreme Court, likely later this month. We'll see what the court does with that case. We have another case just over the river from here in the Washington, D.C. area in Montgomery County. This was a board that didn't like the numbers of students in its middle school magnet programs, so it came up with a complicated formula involving what they called peer norming to try to bring down the numbers of Asian Americans. And finally, we have a similar case in New York City involving its super magnet schools like Stuyvesant High School.
Yeah, and it appears as if the common denominator is, very often the common denominator is that there is an attempt to suppress the percentage of Asian Americans, to a lesser extent white Americans, and to elevate the percentage of Black Americans and Hispanic Americans. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and that was part of the issue at Harvard. But here we are at a primary school where, we're not colleges. And are these private or are they state, for the audience's benefit, are they private schools or state financed schools?
TJ is a public school, also Boston Latin, Stuyvesant, all of these are as well. they're special because, unlike other public schools, not everybody who wants to can go. Earlier with TJ, there was an exam. With these others, there's some other admissions procedure.
Now, obviously, there's a difference between high schools and college, but you know, for the uninformed, such as myself, I look at students for fair admissions at Harvard, some other cases, you know, the Grutter and Gratz cases, and I say to myself, well, wait a minute, how can these schools go ahead and, you know, let's put the law aside for a second, how can our society countenance discrimination on the basis of race? How did the Fourth Circuit come up with their determination, and what was it?
So they did it on two grounds. The first one is a little bit in the weeds. They, we were arguing 73% to 54%. This is a big drop. This shows the new policy had an adverse effect on Asian Americans. They said that this wasn't really adverse effect because Asian Americans were still overrepresented. This is a big problem because it basically means that even if there's pretty clear-cut evidence of discrimination against students from a particular group, you can't find discrimination if they're overrepresented. Justice Alito, in his opinion, dissenting from the denial of certiorari on the Supreme Court, gave a great example. Imagine a school district that has a basketball team that's disproportionately Black. A racist school official wants there to be fewer Blacks on the basketball team. So the coach finds a way to make that 85% Black basketball team have fewer Black players using some pretext. If Blacks are still overrepresented on the basketball team, under the Fourth Circuit theory, you couldn't prove discrimination. As Justice Alito said, he doesn't think there's a single justice on the Supreme Court who would go for that, nor should there be. Why things should be different if the students in question happen to be Asian American instead is beyond me. I think it's a very unfair result.
Yeah. So for our audience, the case, Fourth Circuit decided, I guess the best elocution would be they decided in favor of Thomas Jefferson School, that is permitting the discrimination to continue, and the cert was denied, correct? That is,
yeah.
There's no appeal to the Supreme Court, so that the law of that case stands as is. That is, hey, you can discriminate on the basis of race in certain circumstances in primary, secondary schools. All right. It's a little bit different than in Harvard, but that is the law of the land right now. Is there anything else coming through the pipeline that might adjust that, might find its way to the Supreme Court so that we can get rid of discrimination at the high school level?
So I alluded to a few other Pacific Legal Foundation cases earlier. The one that's farthest along is Boston Latin. There are similar facts to TJ, outstanding magnet school, famous alumni stretching back through the centuries, including Samuel Adams, Cotton Mather, the man who designed the Capitol. Lots of famous Bostonians you recognize from your American history classes in school. Again, there in that case, the board felt there were too many Asian American and white students, too few students from other groups, and so they restructured an admissions process that had largely been based on test scores and grades to one that was largely based on zip code to get them the racial numbers they wanted. That case is facts that are even arguably worse than TJ's. The board members were in private test messages produced in discovery, making fun of Asian American last names, making fun of an Asian American parent who was up in front of the microphone. They resigned afterwards after a public outcry, but not before they had put this discriminatory policy in place. So maybe the board will decide that this particular case is a better fit. While this particular bad case came out of the Fourth Circuit, the Federal Appellate Court for Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, there are 10 other federal circuit, there's 10 other federal appellate courts in which if a case gets through, they could decide to go the other way from the Fourth Circuit. And I would hope that another set of judges would look at this and say, this isn't fair, this isn't right. It discriminates against individuals. If you're an Asian American kid, it shouldn't matter that your group is overrepresented. What should matter is that you're denied this opportunity to attend this life-changing high school of your dreams for no reason other than because of your race. And if another court goes the other way, that would lead to what's called a circuit split, and that could get the Supreme Court to revisit this very bad
right.
decision.
Yeah. And speaking of revisiting, it was a 7-2 decision, correct? That is, you only had Alito and Thomas, the two reliable conservatives, constitutional conservatives, that decided that, you know, what TJ was doing was wrong. I'm a little puzzled. Maybe you've got some insight, and I admit I haven't read, you know, the history of the case, and I haven't read, I only know about the outcome and have read a little bit of the opinion, but have not studied it, and that's why I wanted you on, is did Roberts write an opinion, or was he part of an opinion?
Chief Justice Roberts didn't write that opinion, no.
Okay, but he joined the opinion, correct?
He didn't join the Alito Thomas opinion in TJ.
No, what I mean is the majority opinion.
So because it's a denial, there's no majority opinion. There's
okay, got it, got majority. It, got it, got it. All right, okay, good. And because it's strange to me that, you know, the denial of cert, where you've got a Justice Roberts who was very clear in Parents Involved in Seattle versus Parents Involved versus Seattle School District. He had the famous elocution, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is stop discriminating on the basis of race. And based on the description you've just given, it seems to me that it is almost undeniable that there was discrimination on the basis of race at TJ. And so does this give you, and I think you've just indicated, does this give you hope that in Boston Latin or some of the others that perhaps a Roberts and others might decide that, hey, you know what, we can't permit this kind of overt, what appears to be overt discrimination, especially when you've got, you know, the kind of evidence that you've been talking about. Do you think that, do you feel reasonably optimistic about your prospects for further litigation?
So it's really hard to say. As you know, the Supreme Court denies certiorari in the vast majority of petitions that go before it. It's something like a 1% rate, so it's hard to feel too confident when you have those kind of numbers. That said, the Chief Justice has been a strong voice against race discrimination. He wrote a great opinion in Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard. What's interesting about it is that he actually went out of his way to talk about the kind of discrimination that we see in TJ. This is where you have a school, and Boston Latin too, for that matter. In those cases, here we have school boards that aren't directly saying we're doing reverse discrimination or affirmative action or what you want to call it. These are cases where the board picked proxies for race and tried to use those instead of using race directly. In Students for Fair Admissions, Chief Justice Roberts was pretty clear in the college and university context that that kind of thing shouldn't fly. He said that you can't use essays or other tools to replace the kind of regime of discrimination that the court said was unlawful in Students for Fair Admissions. He quoted a much older case to say what cannot be done directly cannot be done indirectly. And that I read as a kind of signal that the court was open to these kinds of cases of more indirect discrimination, like you see in Coalition for TJ, like you see in Boston Latin. So maybe for whatever reason, the justices didn't think Coalition for TJ was the right vehicle, but maybe they'll see that Boston Latin or some other case is the right vehicle to show that in discrimination cases, what you can't do directly, you can't do indirectly.
Allison, do you have any data as to how common this kind or any kind of discrimination is at the high school level? I recognize TJ, Boston Latin are kind of sui generis. They are outstanding schools. They've got they pull from a wide geographic area, and they're not like most public schools, high schools, that, you know, you've got a certain district within a city or a political subdivision, and students come from there. But to the extent, if you've done any analysis on this, how widespread is this kind of discrimination or any kind of racial discrimination in the admissions process for high schools or even grade schools?
It's hard because, as you say, these schools are pretty special. Most public schools aren't selective at all. We do have numerous anecdotes As I said, there are these, there's other cases earlier on in the pipeline. It looks like in Chicago, there are news reports that they want to shut down some of their magnet schools, change their admissions procedures because of concerns about racial numbers. There was a similar fight in California about Lowell High School, an outstanding school in San Francisco. At the college and university level, there is abundant evidence that in spite of the strong Harvard University decision, a lot of schools want to try to use workarounds to get the kind of racial numbers they got before. The Cato Institute did a great brief in our TJ case that basically ran through statements by university presidents, by state governors, even by President Biden and his officials in the Civil Rights Office Department of Education, basically saying, we're committed to trying to subvert this decision as best we can, and in many cases being shockingly candid about how they plan to do it. So as great as Students for Fair Admissions is, I think that there's going to be a lot of cases brought in the future because a lot of schools are just going to try to get around this as best they can.
It's really remarkable. We've got admissions of intent on the part of public officials that no matter what, we're going to keep discriminating. We don't care what the courts have to say. We're in a kind of peculiar point in time, and I'm glad that Pacific Legal Foundation is doing the work that it's doing. Is there a website people can go to, Allison, if they want to learn more or maybe contribute to the Pacific Legal Foundation?
Absolutely. We have a website at pacificlegal.org. That's pacificlegal, all one word, .org.
Excellent. Allison, thanks very much. This has been very informative. I hope our audience members we'll look further into what Pacific Legal Foundation is up to. This is the kind of thing that you've got to keep an eye on. It's a good thing that PLF is doing this and has individuals who spend time on this because most of us are going about our daily lives. And even if, though I'm on the Civil Rights Commission, I might not necessarily be aware of these things unless I go to the websites of outstanding organizations like Pacific Legal Foundation and see what's going on. I may be kind of tangentially aware, but doing the deep dive is imperative. And you get this kind of stuff in layman's terms at Pacific Legal Foundation, and you guys are doing great work. Good luck to you. Keep us informed as to how things are going. Say hello to Ilya for me, and we'll see you later. Take care.
Thank you so much.
That was Allison Soman, Pacific Legal Foundation. Very highbrow discussion because this is the smartest audience in Cleveland. This is Pete Kersenow sitting in for Bob France. Always right. I mean, we are always right, and when we come back, I'm not sure what we're going to be doing, frankly. We're going to be talking to somebody, but when we do, it's going to be a lot of fun. Pete Kersenow, Bob France, we'll be coming back at the other side.
All of your options.
This hour of Always Right Radio is brought to you by The Floor King and KeepingMedicareSimple.com.
You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance.
This is Always Right Radio with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer.
We're in the third hour of Always Right. This is Pete Kersenow substituting for the irreplaceable Bob France on this Good Friday morning. So far, it's been a pretty jam-packed morning. We've had three different guests talking about some of the most important and pivotal issues in America today and the kind of things that I think will drive some of the decision-making of voters coming up with the election in November. We talked to John Stover of Ohio Value Voters, and I think that, you know, the foundational aspect of everything that OVV and John Stover do is what makes this country great and hopefully preserves this country. We also had J. Christian Adams, who I consider to be the premier, and many people consider to be the premier election law expert in the country, telling us that, you know, there's still certain issues, maybe not as dire. It looks like Republicans are getting their act together to preserve the integrity of the ballot box. They learned their lesson to some extent, but, you know, the Democrats are up at all hours of the night coming up with ways to improve their prospects, aside from trying to convince voters to adopt their ridiculous policies, but improve their prospects electorally. And we had Alison Soman. It was a very cerebral discussion, which I'm glad we had, about the continued impetus to discriminate on the basis of race in so many of our institutions. It's already now going through K through 12. So when I was coming onto the show, a friend of the show, Peter Jettick, said, "Hey, I got a way of solving all of our problems." Now, I'm just exaggerating. I want to put him on the spot. It had to do with the national debt. So I said, "Why don't you come on and talk about it, and we'll see what we can do." I mean, we've got a national debt now. Everybody who drives down 77, which I do fairly regularly, sees that debt clock. And it seemed to be just the day before yesterday, but I'm exaggerating, that when I looked at the debt clock, it was at $10 trillion. And I remember I was aghast at the time. And I remember talking to some of my law partners about it and saying this was unsustainable, that we're going to have a great economic implosion. And lo and behold, it didn't take much time whatsoever. I think, I don't remember this, don't quote me on it, but there's somebody had come up with this formulation that it took us something like the first 200 years of the Republic, the United States of America, it took 200 years to get to a national debt of like $1 trillion, and then 10 years more after that to get to 10 trillion, and then just another few years, I think it's been 6 years, to get to where we are now. So this is a huge problem. As I've indicated before, we're talking about the amount of debt per person. Your tax dollars, 60% of it is going to paying off some version of the national debt before we even get to national defense and securities. In other words, it's eating up the budget for government to do the most essential functions of government. And the one that's most threatening, of course, is, hey, national defense. China's building out its military infrastructure like nobody's business. One of these days we'll talk about that. Don't purport to be an expert on it, but I do read Jane's Defense Weekly on a weekly basis, or Jane's Defense on a weekly basis, and I try to immerse myself in this as much as possible. Sometimes I have to so I can write my fiction. Also, you have to have a background in these things, and I talk to people in the know. And China is on the march, figuratively speaking. Russia's on the march, literally speaking, but our adversaries are not falling asleep. They're devoting significant resources to overtaking the United States of America, and we are sleepwalking with this administration. Look, I think we've got the greatest military personnel in the world, but you take a look at some of our leadership. I'll leave it to our listeners to decide whether or not these are the best and brightest, whether or not these are guys that are the most motivated, and whether or not they emulate in any respect MacArthur, Patton, or some of the other great military leaders of the past, who, for all their personal faults, nonetheless, were military geniuses. My favorite, of course, and I think having spoken to many audience members, is the most colorful, George Patton. There's a lot of things that you can say about him, but most people thought that he was the greatest tactical battlefield general that we've had, other than maybe Stonewall Jackson, but it was a different era back then. And I've read every Patton book. I'm quoted in a few Patton books. In fact, one of the quotes was I can't remember the name of the book. But I remember that my brother-in-law got me this book for Christmas. It was about Patton. And I'm sitting there, and I open it up. And, of course, Patton is one of my passions. And lo and behold, I see a reference to, as Pete Kersnow described in blah, 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 I'd written about Patton. And I said, "This is the greatest Christmas present I ever got. My interest in Patton plus a rubbing of the ego. It's a real stroking of the ego. So that was great. But I'm not so sure where we are today. Anyway, got far afield. Talk about the national debt. Let's go to my friend Peter Jettick. Peter, are you there?
Hey, Peter, how you doing?
You know, I've got this herniated disc that I keep complaining about like a wimp. But other than that, all life is grand.
Herniated disc. I had one of those many years ago. You better get that fixed and take your relief factor. Best thing you can do for your back.
Well, we're going to do that. So how are you going to save the world, Peter?
Well, I guess buy my book, Why America is Bankrupt, Who Did It, and How to Fix It, or go to my website, peterjedekforpresident.com. We got to get that rid of that debt. Like you said, that debt is eating up all our wealth. You know, we're a wealthy country, except we have to admit that we're bankrupt, that our country is $34 trillion in debt, and like you said, more and more of our tax money is just going to pay interest on our debt. So we don't have enough money left over to buy ships for the Navy. You just talked about it just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, and I'm afraid, you know, Social Security, although everyone says that, well, there's no issue with respect to that because the manner in which it's preserved. I never believe any of that stuff. Just my standard approach to anything related to what the government says is sheer and utter skepticism. And let's face it, the numbers just don't work out. I don't care. First of all, there is no trust fund, so to speak. That's a fiction. But nonetheless, we've got these, you know, Peter, I don't know if you look at the national debt clock. I know some of the listeners do. You can go to the national debt clock, and that thing is spinning like crazy. And it's amazing at the level of debt per capita and the amount of money that it's eating up in terms of the necessary expenditures of government. So this is a serious problem that, unfortunately, no one talks about. They don't want to talk about it. It's almost like whistling past the graveyard. So how do we get out of this fix?
Well, there's a whole bunch of ideas I have. Like I said, one of the main thing is you have to do like the states do. Like you need a balanced budget amendment. You have to put an amendment to the Constitution. Not like Ohio, where they pass an amendment every week. You know, it's hard to put an amendment. A balanced budget amendment, like we have in Ohio, you only spend as much as you bring in. And then we're going to have to cancel a lot of this debt and cut out and take a scalpel to the federal government. The federal government is involved in all this stuff that they shouldn't be involved in. Like I'm using my website about student loans, you know. They've been giving out student loans for the last 20 years or so. They shouldn't be, and the kids owe all this money to the government, and they're like indentured servants. You know, they owe money to the federal government. Shouldn't be in the business of education. It shouldn't be. That's the state's job. The federal government is in all these programs that they shouldn't be in. And
Peter, I'm going to display my ignorance here, which is profound, but do you have any idea as to who's holding the debt? I mean, I've seen different explanations. You know, China holds some of our principal adversaries are holding our debt.
Right.
You know, and I know banks are holding. Do you know who the biggest debt holder is of our national debt?
No, there's a bunch. A lot of them have. Like I mentioned on Bob's show, we talked about this, you know. You got these countries. Why are they even allowed to buy our debt? Why are we even letting them buy our debt like China? They're our enemy, you know. And And if they owe $1 trillion in debt, say, hey, goodbye. We're not paying you back. We've been, you know, you're our enemy. But a lot of the debt is owned by pensions. Like, you know, the Teamsters have a pension fund. And what they do with their pension money, they buy the government bonds. You know, they make interest on it. And they use that interest to pay, you know, the pensions. So you can't just eliminate it that easy. Or you'd put the whole country would, you know, you'd have a huge depression. So it's not that easy. But what you have to do is start whittling down this federal government debt, the federal government, because instead of making the debt bigger every year, they're making it smaller every year. They have to turn it around and go in a different direction. The easiest way is whittling down the federal government.
What about eliminating? I know this is, once a federal program gets established, it goes on like the Terminator forever. It's almost impossible to get rid of a program because it starts to develop certain constituencies around it. And it continues to breathe life into it, and there are very, very few politicians who have the guts to turn off the spigot because they're afraid of losing the votes that are attendant to that particular program. So do you have any idea, from a political standpoint, how can this be? I mean, you've got to marshal the efforts, the motivation of politicians to actually do some of these things. And how does that happen?
Well, once their salary starts, it just starts hitting their salary, but they get so much money like Biden, you know, like I talked about, Bob, once first thing you got to do is term limits, get rid of these politicians that spend 50 years there like Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and become super millionaires on a $100,000 salary, you know. But I have some good ideas if you want to talk about some of my specific ideas. Like, I think we need to change our tax system. You know, I just did my income taxes, and I have a small business. I'm a book publisher. I have one employee, me, and you just see all the paperwork I have to do and all the, you know, all the stuff you have to do for one, just a one-man business. Imagine what Trump has to do. You know, if I say get rid of this income tax and make it a flat tax, get rid of all these deductions and all these loopholes that these millionaires have, say everybody pays 10%, rich or poor, no matter what, and then you wouldn't have to hire 34,000 IRS agents like Biden just did, you know. And that would save them. That would make the cost of the federal government would be cheaper, and you'd have a. You would know how much you have coming in every year. Everybody just pays 10%, no deductions, no loopholes, you know, so things like that. You know, you have to really redesign this whole federal government.
Peter, from your perspective, assuming a prudent reduction in government expenditures, do you have any kind of a timeline for how long it would take, if you had the political will to do it, how long it would take to get the national debt to, I don't know what a manageable level will be, considering that we're at $34 trillion. How long before we say get back to where we were just about 15 years ago, $10 trillion?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not an expert on economics. But I think, like you said, I would take these countries that bought our debt that are our enemies, that, like I said, whatever China, we owe China, say, hey, China, we're bankrupt. Sorry, you gave us money. We're not giving any back to you. That'd cut a big chunk of it right away. You know, like a lot of these countries, that they shouldn't be allowed to buy our debt anyway if you're our enemy. You know?
Well, I agree with that. One of the concerns that I've got is if we do something like that, first of all, if you default, then that creates a whole set of problems. Second, you know, it could precipitate a war. If we say, hey, China, you're not getting your money back. There are all kinds of ramifications that go with that. Is there a way that, and nobody wants to increase taxes, is there a way to just kind of wait out the debt? In other words, with interest rates, expenditures, so on and so forth, that at some point on the horizon, the debt might go away? Sounds fanciful, but I've read from certain economists that could happen if we had some discipline.
Oh, that'd be great. Like I said, I'm not an economist, but I have my ideas for just cutting the debt, you know, just getting the federal government out of all these programs.
Peter, what's the name of your book?
Why America is Bankrupt, Who Did It, and How to Fix It. And I wrote it 10 years ago, and at the time the debt was only $20 trillion. And I went to Washington, D.C. to a prayer conference with the 2016 election, you know, before Trump got involved. And I took it, and all these politicians were there, like Senator Rubio and Senator Cruz. I gave them, met them all, gave them copies of my book. I said, hey, we got to turn this debt around. They said, yeah, yeah. They went back to Washington and didn't do anything about it, you know. And it's just they don't care as long as they get their pay, and, you know, it's just no crime. And those guys are good guys, you know.
Yeah.
And then you got the Democrats who just like to spend every other people's money. I listened to Bob, I think, on Monday. He has his 9 headlines, and the 9 at 9. And his headlines were all about these programs, these earmarks, where they throw away millions and millions of dollars on these crazy programs. You know, the city of Cleveland does the same thing. Our little city of Cleveland, which, you know, is a big city, but they have millions of, they throw away, toss around millions of dollars like it's nothing. You know?
They are, and various levels of government are spending money like there's no tomorrow. We're printing money, which devalues the money, which leads to inflation, and here we are. This can't continue. There's going to be an implosion at some point unless we get some type of a handle on this. Everyone's kind of whistling past the graveyard, believing that, well, we can just conduct business as usual, throw money around to buy votes, and we're just going to be happy all, you know, forever and ever, amen. But that's not the case. Peter, thanks for calling. I appreciate you. This and the name of your book, again, repeat it one more time. Is Peter there? Oh, Peter's gone already. Well, in any event, it was Peter Jedek. He's written a couple of books I've read, and, you know, just look him up and go from there. But I want to get to, do we have time to go to John? Let's go to John in Chardon. John, how you doing?
Hey, last summer I attended one of your speaking engagements.
Condolences.
And you wouldn't say this on air, but you told us something about yourself And what it was, I think I have this right. You went to Cornell University, and you were a student athlete. In other words, you played football, and you you did well in your grades, your SAT, and so on. And the president was elated because of that. Anyway, that's the first thing I wanted to tell you about. And the next thing is something about Biden. I know a woman who she's a retired brain surgeon. And in D.C., she operated on Biden on the left side of his brain, on one side of his brain. And then a year later, he was back and she operated on the other side of his brain. And this is an exact quote from this woman. She says, "You can take it from me. With those two operations, the passage of all this time, he doesn't have much between the ears."
Yeah, well, I think you can get that from observation. I don't want to be cruel or anything of that nature, but he clearly is not competent to do the job of the presidency. I'm not telling anybody in the audience something they don't already know. I'm a little surprised that a physician would speak about something like that.
Well, she spoke to me personally. She didn't go public with it.
Understood. You know? Look, I'm just a lawyer. I'm not a doctor. But as a professional, I would never disclose any confidences. I'm not saying that she is or anything like that. But nonetheless, yeah. She's not telling us anything that we don't already know. It just is with a source. It lends it a little bit more credibility. When we observe Biden, you know, look, the media covers for him, and is every time they keep doing that, either cutting away or trying to explain away certain difficulties, it just magnifies it even more. No one believes that this individual. I remember, and I may have mentioned it once on the France show back in the, I think it was the mid to late 90s. I testified before some committee of the Senate. It may have been the, I don't remember which one it was. I think it may have been the HELP Committee, which is the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, probably. And Biden was one of the senators on the panel. And he would ask certain questions. And again, this is nearly 30 years ago, John. And I came back home after my testimony. And I didn't care about Biden. He was just another senator. You know, he was on nobody's radar screen. And I said to my wife and to one of my partners at the law firm, I said, "This may very well be the dumbest senator on the face of the earth." And then it was confirmed several years later. I was testifying in one of the Senate Supreme Court nomination hearings. It may have been Roberts or Alito. I don't remember which. And I hear the music coming. I'll just make this very brief. One of these days I'll tell the whole story because it's kind of funny. But, I'm talking about the law and the opinions that the justice had written. And Biden asked a question. I gave him an answer that was flippant, which I should never have done. This is not what you, don't try this at home, and I'm not encouraging youngsters to do this, but it was a flippant answer. And Biden didn't get it. He didn't get the fact that I was kind of making fun of him. Kennedy, who was seated right next to him, rolled his eyes when Biden didn't understand what was going on, and the audience was chuckling, but Biden was still mystified. He had that, you remember the RCA dog? They had his head tilted. He had that look on his face, like, what was he just talking about?
No,
this is not the brightest bulb in the world, and unfortunately, he is the leader of the free world. John, thanks very much. You have a blessed Easter, and thanks very much for calling. I hear the music telling us that we're going to the bottom of the hour. Pete Kersenow for Bob France. And we'll come back at the other side of the break. Got a couple more stats for you talking about this particular election coming up. Pete Kersenow for Bob France on Always
The Answer.
Hello, Cleveland. We're going into the final segment. We've got calls holding. I want to get to them momentarily. But I also, before we go any further, make sure that we recognize our brave Vietnam veterans. It's Vietnam Veterans Memorial Day. This was, many of us don't, you know, many people in the audience probably don't remember clearly the conflict. It seems to have faded into history. For me, it seemed very, very recent. But we've got a number of individuals, a number of friends. I've got family members, my brother-in-law, for example, who served a number of tours in Vietnam. These were great Americans, and want to acknowledge our Vietnam veterans. Let's do this as quickly as possible. Try to keep your comments or questions short. Tom, how are you, Tom?
I'm okay. How are you, Peter?
I'm doing all right.
Good. Sorry I missed the show earlier. I hope I'll try to cover this.
Well, heck, how could you miss this spectacular show? Tom, I don't know. I'm going to have to hang up on you, I think. Go ahead.
I want to try to address as quickly as I can what I think is an incomplete and confusing message that the Republicans and conservative media keep uttering about President Biden. First, they start with the proposition that he is cognitively challenged. He's an empty suit. He's confused. He can't even read. But then every time a major policy, disastrously large policies are announced and effected, they same folks just charge Biden only. And the real truth of the matter is, and Biden himself effectively admits this, that he doesn't really make these decisions. Right. Rather, his handlers or those who are telling him he can't say this and he can't do that, the kingpins of the Democratic Party make those decisions. And that needs to be told along with the other first two premises, and to the American people, that is, so that they understand that the same people who picked him almost 3 years ago are the same people who are perfectly capable of deposing him come the convention or some other time if the polls remain where they are, so that the American public needs to know that when a fresh face, so to speak, is introduced in Chicago or wherever before the election, it's not going to be a fresh face. It's going to be the same representative of the same entity, the same cabal that's been making all the bad decisions, and while that fresh. So that if you want to be credible, attacking such person as not being going to be the same, need to start educating the American people now that that's what's been going on all along from start to finish in the Biden administration.
Yeah, Tom, that's an insightful point. I'm glad you made it. And my concern has always been that Michelle Obama might be the replacement, and we can talk about that at some later point when we've got more time. But
all the more reason they need education now, because when she appears, you know, it's going to be hell to pay.
Right. Tom, thanks for your comments,
yes,
and
sir.
You have a good Easter. Let's go to Joe in Westlake.
Hello, Pete. First, not even NFL players survive the NFL, so keep that in mind.
I just before I leave this mortal coil, I want to play one play in the NFL. Growing up as a little kid in Cleveland, I remember my hero was Jim Brown. I just want one play with the Browns. It would be like the Christians and the Lions. People would pay for that. They really would, just to see me get killed. Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I'd pay for it, and I'd think you'd win. Now, here's something unpleasant I have to share. This is a Machiavellian statement. You're sophisticated. I'm sure you can, you know, get this. Just because Hamas is a horrible terrorist group that kills thousands of people doesn't mean that it's a good idea to use any level of force to get rid of them, because that's going to have other consequences. For example, the International Court of Justice is now demanding that Israel go to a ceasefire, and there are numerous reports from reporters around the world that a great famine involving potentially hundreds of thousands of deaths is underway in Gaza. Yes, let's get rid of Hamas, but let's not destroy the diplomatic reputation of two countries at the same time. And one final thing, I think the next step for the Obama-Biden criminal gang will be a black flag civil war to allow the Democratic candidate to win. This is shown by Obama's movie, The End of It All. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Let's go to Bruce in Seven Hills.
Hiya, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
As anybody can answer this question in this short period of time, it would be you. Article 4, Section 4, the United States is supposed to protect each state against an invasion.
Right, and if they don't, then the states can take their own measures.
So that's the enforcement, allowing the states to do it.
Yep, absolutely. I think the Supreme Court is, you know, thinking about this. They're weighing in on it. Various courts have. I think a plain reading of the Constitution says that if there is an invasion, and that's what we've got, the southern border, if 8 million people coming across. Look, I'm trying to remember the exact figures when Nazi Germany invaded Poland, but I think it was something like, it was either, don't quote me on this, I thought in my mind I had 900,000. We have got 8 million people coming into this country that we think that's the number. We don't even have a handle on the number. It's an invasion, and we need to act with common sense. This is craziness. We talked about this yesterday. I don't want to dwell on it too much. And when we're back on next week, we'll talk about it a little bit more. I want to get to the remainder of the callers before we're done here. Bruce and Bruce left. Do we have Tom in Medina?
Hi, Pete. I know my friend who lives in Medina in 2020 got three different ballots from three different people. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay. He got ballots for three different families. That means they were all still registered at his house. Well, what we need to do is I'm going to go down next week, and I'm going to go to the Board of Elections and see how many people are registered at my house. And then that's the only way you can do it. That's what's happening. There's people registered at your house you don't even know about.
Yeah,
so that's my suggestion.
Yeah, Tom, thanks very much. You know, we talked to Christian Adams earlier in this program about all of the irregularities, the kind of things such as, you know, cleaning up the voter rolls. And people say, well, what's the big deal about cleaning up the voter rolls, and why do Democrats assiduously try to avoid it? Because there are names on the rolls of people who've long since been deceased, people who've moved out of that jurisdiction. And lo and behold, as Christian Adams has noted, what happens when you've got these kind of ambulatory, these zombie names on the voter rolls is somehow ballots are cast in their name. I don't know. Boy, it's a real mystery how that happens. And it's a real mystery also how all these ballots happen to go only in one direction. They never go in favor of Republicans. They always go in favor of Democrats. These are not, made-up stories. Christian Adams litigates these things all over the country. We've got multiple examples of this at the Civil Rights Commission. One of our charters is to address issues related to voting rights. These, as I've said at the outset of this program, if in your experience on this planet you have a certain belief as to how things are running, what's going on, trust your instincts on it, because 9 times out of 10, the media, which is in league with progressives, they are indistinguishable, is going to suppress, obfuscate, distort news that is damaging to the left. On the other hand, they're going to promote, exaggerate, and even make up news that is damaging or allegedly damaging to the right. And the biggest example of that is Russia, 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 all of which was false, didn't deter the left at all. In fact, they're still talking about Russia. It's truly extraordinary. This is Pete Kersenow for Bob France on Always Right. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to my friends in the Cleveland area, the best-looking people, the smartest people, the toughest people, the fastest people on the face of the earth. We've got a country to save, folks. So every single day, make sure, in addition to taking care of your family, taking care of your job, taking care of...
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.